And I need at the outset to acknowledge also that Rabbi Weiss and Rabbi Linzer are coming to the shul under the auspices of Yeshiva Chovei Vetera, which has been kind enough to partner with this year's Summer Beit Midrash, and so I'm really appreciative of their support of the program, and that they're willing to become part of the shul program as well. Okay, so the topic we have for tonight is stem cell research in Jewish law. And I don't intend to come to definitive conclusions. I think that far greater scholars than I have already written articles on the subject, coming, of course, to radically different conclusions. And in particular, as we'll see, right, this is one of the many areas of Jewish medical ethics that are subject to a dispute between Rabbi Moshe David Hendler and Rabbi J. David Bleich. So full disclosure, I should say at the outset that I am a student of Rabbi Bleich. Although I think it is clear, as Rabbi Sender pointed out, that our position here differs dramatically from that of the Catholic Church, it doesn't mean that what our position is perfectly clear. What I want to what I want to do with you tonight, hopefully, is to give you a sense, some of the sense of what the issues are from a halachic perspective, and secondly, to use this issue as a way of illustrating what I think is a useful halachic approach to issues of this sort. And we'll discuss exactly what issues of this sort are in the context of the shir. In the course of the shir, we'll make reference to some topics that I think are basic for understanding how modern halachic medical ethics develop. And we'll develop, I hope, a lot of those themes Sunday night as well. We're actually going to do the detail first, right? And then we'll move into the broader foundations of Jewish medical ethics on Sunday. Okay, so some terminological issues are appropriate to start with. We talk about stem cell research, right? So usually in the public eye, we talk about stem cell research and cloning. What I learned when I was preparing a presentation on the subject for Hadassah is that a lot of the political battle around this is fought about words. So, for example, stem cells can be derived either from pre-embryos or from blastocytes. You can figure out for yourself that those who are opposed to the cultivation of stem cells refer to pre-embryos, and those who are pro talk about blastocytes, because everybody understands that embryos are something serious, and even pre-embryos are close, whereas blastocytes, what are they? Right? For all we know, they're an element of the periodic table or something like that. All right, what difference could it possibly make? The second issue is whether one talks about somatic nuclear transfer or cloning. Very often you will find politicians particularly speaking at great length about how we are not in any way talking about cloning, we are talking about somatic nuclear transfer. That is a clue that either the politician has no idea what he's talking about, or he's lying. Because in fact there is no difference. Right? Somatic nuclear transfer is the scientific term for cloning. Now we'll see that there are consequences to that. There's a reason why you want to do that, because whether cloning of cells necessarily leads to cloning of full human beings is an issue, right? Everyone knows that there seems a fairly clear consensus across pretty much all religious and the scientific community that cloning human beings would be a bad idea, right? So nobody wants to be in favor of cloning of any sort. But in reality, right, there is no difference in the scientific process by which stem cells are cloned and by which one could, in principle, produce a complete human being from a stem cell. Okay, that's background for the, background for the material. Okay. So what does halakha have to say about stem cell research? So we have to begin by saying something that may seem a little bit shocking, which is that it's really unlikely that the sages of the Talmud were aware of stem cells. Right? It's not impossible. I don't know what they knew or didn't know, but it's really unlikely. Therefore, it's not so likely that one is likely to find a Talmudic discussion which explicitly addresses the question of what one should do with regard to stem cell research. And that same problem is true with regard to medieval sources, and for that matter, with regard to 19th century sources, and for that matter, with regard to pretty much all rabbinic material prior to 1990 or so. Right, so the question is, what does one do when one has a halachic topic which it is unlikely that that precedent actually considered directly? Right? So this is a debate, and I hope that I'll be able to find it in time for us to study this on Sunday. This is a this question was set out in a dialogue between Rabbi Ezra Bick of Yeshivat Har Etzion and Rabbi J. David Blythe some years ago in the journal Tradition on not exactly this topic, but a similar topic. And the issue that came up with is, what do you do if you have a new case which you have to acknowledge is not explicitly addressed by precedent? So one way of approaching it is to say, well, we'll deal with the closest possible case in halakha and try and extend it. Or if you don't even have a case in halakha, we'll look for the closest thing elsewhere in rabbinic literature. Let's say, for example, if we can find a story somewhere in a midrash, and that's the best we have, right? So we're going to utilize that. Right, so for example, one might decide issues relating to in vitro fertilization, whether we consider the child born from IVF to be the child of the egg mother or the child of the birth mother, on the basis of Midrash, which explains that originally Leah was in Rachel's womb. Sorry, not Leah. Originally, Dina was in Rachel's womb, but Leah realized that would end up with Rachel having fewer children than the Shvachot, right, than the maidservants in the tribes of Israel, and therefore she prayed, and the male child in her womb, Binyamin, was shifted with Rachel, and so an embryo which began its life in Leah's womb was born from Rachel's womb, and we can now presume that this embryo was created from Leah's egg. Since it complicates the issue unnecessarily to assume that an egg from Rachel made it into Leah's womb and then was transferred back as a result of Leah's prayer. Now, that is the best evidence we have in rabbinic literature for the question of birth mother versus egg mother. So one might say, well, if that's the best evidence we have, well, let's use it. Right? And since we all know that Dina is considered not Leah, we have now solved the problem and determined that it is the birth mother and not the egg mother. Or you could say, you know what? We don't really know. Right? That's not really right. We don't really have any evidence. And what we have to do is deal with it not on the basis of the text, which is specifically closest, but on the basis of a general perception of what Jewish values on the issue of motherhood and birth are. All right? We have to acknowledge that we don't have direct precedent. Rabbi Weiss taught me that this was a dispute between the Chazon Ish and the Shach, with the Shach taking the position that there can be cases on which there is no genuine precedent, and the Chazon Ish saying that there always is a precedent, so the closest precedent is the precedent. But on this one, I have to say that while my Rebbe likes the position of the Chazon Ish, I tend to favor the position of the Shach, and in the debate between Rabbi Blythe and Rabbi Bick, well, we can talk about, and we will, I hope, on Sunday, talk about some details of that. On the whole, I prefer to take the position that halakha has decided when there is no direct precedent on the basis of more general values and principles rather than on the closest available midrash. Okay. So with that as background, so then we have to figure out how are we going to approach the question of stem cell research, granted that no precedent will explicitly discuss that question. So one way of approaching it, the starting point for approaching it, is to say that the problem with stem cell research on the surface of it is that you have an embryo which has the capacity to develop into a full human being. Right? And as stem cell research is currently constituted, the way in which it happens is that that you have an embryo which has the capacity to generate a full human being, and in order to harvest the stem cells, you have to stop it from developing permanently. Right, so you destroy its capacity to become a full human being, and that sounds something like abortion. Right, so the first context within which halakha can address the question of the legitimacy of stem cell research is by saying, well, what is the law? Right, what is the law in terms of abortion, and how would it apply to this? So in that context, sources 1 through 3 on your packet become relevant. We had 30.
This So I don't know quite. I think we must. There must be some missing.
Okay. So source number one.
Right, source number one addresses the question of at what point a woman's tribal identity shifts. Right, the nafkamina is, right, the practical difference is that a woman who is considered to be part of the family of Kohanim is permitted to eat the priestly portion, the truma, and a woman who is not considered to be part of that, right, to be part of that group may not eat truma. Right, the presumption is that a woman born into a family of Kohanim is allowed to eat truma until she, right, until through marriage and motherhood she moves into, right, she moves into the other, into another family and vice versa. Right, so the Mishnah, says that right, if you're dealing with extramarital sex or sex with people who don't have the capacity for marriage and therefore marriage as such does not change the woman's tribal affiliation. So we say that the fact of sex does not change the woman's affiliation. Therefore, if a woman who belongs to a family of Kohanim and therefore is allowed to eat truma, right, has sexual relations outside of marriage with a non-Kohen, that does not change her status. Furthermore, even if she becomes pregnant, once she becomes pregnant, then her status changes. Okay, the fact of pregnancy changes her status. Now she's seen as the mother of a non-Kohen as opposed to as the daughter of a Kohen. If the fetus then aborts, then she's allowed to eat truma again. Vice versa. If a woman belongs to a non-Kohen family, and she has non-marital sexual relations with a Kohen, that's not sufficient to make her part of the Kohen family. And even once she becomes pregnant, it's not sufficient to make her. The only thing other than marriage that can make a woman, move a woman into the family of Kohanim, is having a child. Okay. So the Talmud tries to assimilate this to other cases of the impact of insane people, right, or incompetence, or minors who can't really get married. What's the impact of sex with somebody whom you can't marry? Right, for technical reasons, because they're not capable of marriage. And in that line, the Talmud makes a series of suggestions. And it comes along, right, suggestion that Talmud comes up with is actually Talmud starts with a problem. It says, right, the Mishnah seems to be teaching us that which we learned in a Braita, which says that if an incompetent or a minor married and then they die, their wives are not considered to have been married. Okay, I think I skipped a line here. Talmud then sets up a problem. It says that we have in our Mishnah that a woman who became pregnant is not allowed to eat truma. Even a woman who is part of a Kohen family, right, if she becomes pregnant, she can't eat truma. The question that Talmud wants to know then is, if a pregnant woman, Kohen woman who becomes pregnant from Israel, is not allowed to eat truma. So then, we should really ban her from eating truma from the moment that she has sexual relations, because of the possibility that she's pregnant. Right? She starts off being able to eat truma. Then, right? We say that if she becomes pregnant, she's no longer capable of eating truma. Well, when are we going to know that she became pregnant? Right? We're not going to know it for a fact until it becomes visible, which is 3 months. But we should declare that she's eligible to eat truma from the moment of sex, because maybe she's pregnant. Okay, we have evidence of other cases, right, in which we say because of the chance of pregnancy, we view her as possibly pregnant from the very beginning. So Talmud's answer to that at the end, right, Amar Rachita says, but you know what, we still don't care in the first 40 days, because in the first 40 days, even if she is pregnant, it has no halakhic consequences. Right, in the first, right, that when we say that if she becomes pregnant, she can't eat truma, that's still, right, that only means once she becomes significantly pregnant, and from a Talmudic perspective, you can be a little bit pregnant. Alright, up until 40 days, you're a little bit pregnant, right, to the point it doesn't matter. After 40 days, right? Then you're genuinely pregnant.
Right, and the language that Talmud uses in this regard is that until 40 days, all there is naya ba'alma. It's just water. Okay, this claim that until 40 days, the embryo is considered to be simply water is assumed in two other places. This is source 2 of the 3, although the phrase just water is not used. But a distinction between 40 days and less than 40 days is made in two other places. Both cases dealing with the consequences of early miscarriage, right, where there is a sacrifice that a woman who gives birth is supposed to bring. That sacrifice is not brought if she miscarries before day 40. And thirdly, there are implications in terms of ritual purity if one has given birth, and those implications also do not apply to an infant, to a miscarriage before day 40. Okay. So most attempts to argue that stem cell research in halakha is not at all problematic say, look, we have three places, one place in Talmud states explicitly, and two Mishnayot which assume that a fetus less than 40 days old is not considered to be anything other than water. And what's the problem with using water for medical research? Okay, right. That's the way the argument. The argument stops. Now, this argument, as such, I would say. Now, Rabbi Tendler has, I think, a really startling line in this regard. Rabbi Tendler is quoted all over as saying that a fetus prior to the 40th day of gestation has no moral status in Jewish law. Bintilas Vodo, I can't really conceive of what he meant by that. Because while it is true that the Talmud states that in these three places that there are no consequences, that there are no halachic consequences to an embryo before day 40, there are in fact many other contexts in halacha in which there either certainly or possibly are consequences to an embryo less than 40 days. For example, normative halacha is that we violate Shabbat to save a fetus, even within 40 days. Right, and there's a whole host of other areas. To begin with, what's the halakhic status of a deliberate abortion at that stage without medical justification is not clear. Furthermore, halakha assigns a certain degree of status simply to unfertilized gametes, right, and certainly at least to sperm. Right, and since halakha forbids, according to some commentaries biblically, the destruction, right, the prevention of sperm from fertilizing an egg and then developing into a full human being, it seems unlikely that we regard the sperm having fertilized the egg as having degenerated into mere water. Right? So on the one hand, you do have statements which say that the embryo less than 40 days is mere water. On the other hand, you have a series of places in which embryos less than 40 days have clear halakhic status, of which the simplest is violating Shabbat to save them. Right? By no means is that the only case. We could state, furthermore, that in a non-halakhic context, the Talmud records a dialogue between Rabbi Judah the Prince and probably Marcus Aurelius, though the Talmud doesn't refer to him, but refers to Marcus Antoninus, about when the soul enters the body, in which Marcus Aurelius takes the position that the soul enters at the moment of conception, and the conclusion of the Talmudic story is that he's right, and that we believe that ensoulment occurs at the moment of conception. Now, I don't know what consequences having a soul is, whatever a soul may be, right? That itself is a problematic term. It's an interesting argument. He says that meat rots, right? If you leave dead meat around, it rots. So this meat must be alive. Now, he doesn't take the position as just part of the mother, which is rhetoric he used elsewhere, right? So you have sufficient rhetoric if on which to make a case in reverse that clearly. Even within the first 40 days, an embryo has some kind of halakhic status. I don't know how to parse the notion of moral status. To me, right, I'll just give you an autobiographical illustration of how my own thinking on this issue developed. The most immediate and heartrending example of in which under halakha one would want to be lenient with regard to abortion is the case of Tay-Sachs. Tay-Sachs, as you all know, right, is a disease which gives children a short and deeply unpleasant life.
It's a genetic disease which is prevalent largely in the Ashkenazi community, though the incidence apparently has been cut dramatically by awareness of the situation within the Orthodox community and programs such as Dor Yesharim. But before such programs were created, right, so then the question came up, unfortunately, quite often, right, if one were aware that one's fetus had same sex, could one or could one not abort? On this issue, Rabbi Noshe Feinstein took the strict position, and Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, Yibad al-Lachayim, took the lenient position. I recall one of my first exposures to serious halakha was my Rabbi Rav Mordechai Willig walking into Shir one day and telling us he had been asked this question. Right, could someone abort a tape-back fetus or not? And he looked at us and he said, well, I looked at him and I said, you know, Rav Moshe says that it's forbidden. Waldenberg says that it's permitted. Who am I to choose between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Eliezer Waldenberg? So I sent him to ask Rav Waldenberg.
That is an issue. Right, in which there is a strong tendency to sympathize, right, if one is going with one's sympathies as opposed to strict law, right, as opposed to just reading the law, the tendency is to sympathize with Rabbi Waldenberg's position and not to put people through that. Well, I discovered, so that was, you know, if that issue had ever come up, and Baruch Hashem, that issue never came up for me, right, but if I had been asked that question, I think I would very likely have followed Rabbi Willig's posture and looked at them and said, I'm not confident to decide between them, go ask Rabbi Waldenberg. But then, about 4 years ago, I think, I had a chavruta at Harvard, and we were studying the Eliezer on abortion. And we came across the tshuva that you'll find in source number 4. Okay, this is the Tzitzit Eliezer. Rabbi Waldenberg is, yes. Can I ask a question? No, I think that's very relevant. That's the issue. We have a case which, but you know, this case it doesn't come up so much because they don't have anything to say about it, right? You know, when they say things which we think are problematic, like when they say that lights are spontaneously generated, right? Then we have to deal with the degree of their scientific knowledge. But when an issue which they had no knowledge of whatsoever, right? So to me, it doesn't even come up. It's not that I have any Talmudic statements I have to explain away. I don't have any Talmudic statements at all. Now, you might ask me, what about the 40-day distinction? So the 40-day distinction actually holds up reasonably well, right, in terms of organ differentiation.
What is their source of 40 days?
That's a very good question. There are two stages. I could answer that probably their distinction was based on empirical observation, right, and that probably they did study miscarriages, right, and people did basically know when they became pregnant. And so whether it would be grounded in the same terms as we have, it's probably based on an observational difference. Now, what would happen if it was based on an observational difference that we no longer find scientifically significant, right, that's a good question, and I'll get back to that one perhaps later as we go on.
Yeah, I don't know when this question
yeah.
is.
Okay. Okay, probably. Well, if it's something you don't understand as I'm going along, you should ask. Other than that, we should probably hold it for questions at the end, because I'm going to build the whole thesis, which these questions will matter to. Okay. So, Tzitzit Eliezer, right, who was the postdoc of Shari Tzedek, was asked the following question. I should say, incidentally, by the way, that 40 days is tantalizing, but doesn't help you for Tzedek, because the Tzedek test, as much as they pushed it back, it seemed they never got it below 46 days, or something like that. I mean, we keep pushing it back day by day by day, but they never got it inside 40, and that's where your question became really relevant, because people wanted to suggest maybe 40 days was an approximation, and we can now claim that a critical moment occurred at day 43, and if we can get this into day 42, right, we can do that. But I don't think it ever actually worked to get it that far. Okay, so Tzitzit Eliezer was asked on behalf, right, by the head of the Department of Health, I don't know whether that's a cabinet position or not in Israel, what to do about it. The government set forth a program designed to prevent mentally retarded children from being born, basically, or at least severely mentally damaged children from being born. The most common cause of mental retardation is mongoloidism or Down syndrome. And Down syndrome is prevalent largely, a very high percentage, according to this tshuva, 2% of babies born to women over 40, at least at that time, right, developed Down syndrome.
The government wished to put a screening process in place, right, in which all fetuses born to mothers over 37, right, would be screened for Down syndrome, with the purpose being that those mothers would then be given the option of abortion. And I would point out, which the Sutileather shockingly does not include in this truva, that the process by which Down syndrome is determined is amniocentesis, and amniocentesis actually causes miscarriages in a, right, in a fairly significant percentage of cases. That doesn't seem to enter into his truva, but I can tell you that when this question has come up for me, I think that that's a pretty significant halakhic factor, and it's a fairly astonishing lacuna that this truva never mentions that. In the, right, the Sutileather has asked the question of whether one can engage, whether one can engage in this kind of testing, knowing that the only purpose of this testing is to get, right, is to encourage women, basically, to abort a Down syndrome fetus. So the address is, first of all, the question of whether it would be permitted even if abortion were forbidden. Right? That's not our issue. But then he says, really, there's no issue at all here because the abortion is permitted. Right? And right? He doesn't encourage it, but he permits the abortion on the grounds that the consequences to the consequences for the parents of having a Down syndrome child can be extremely serious psychologically and can threaten the integrity of the marriage, right? And therefore, he is willing to allow abortion in Down syndrome cases. And if you look at that, because the Sutileather takes the position generally, following Nachmanides, that at least early-term abortion is only rabbinic violation. And when I read this, I suddenly said, oh, so the reason that he rules that same-sex abortions are permitted is because he really thinks abortion is only rabbinically prohibited. And the logic that leads him to same-sex abortions, he tells you right here that he doesn't really see a difference between the case of same-sex abortion and the case of, right, and the case of Down syndrome abortion. And so one of the things that one has to be extremely cautious of if one rules in new cases, right, is to try and, right, and to try and figure out not only what the consequences are in the specific case you're dealing with, but what the broader implications are of your ruling. Right, so one has to try, right, so one has to take responsibility not only for the narrow ruling, but also for all the precedents that you're setting. And I have to say that when I read the Sutileather's truva on Down syndrome, I was forced to totally rethink whether I could in fact accept his position on same-sex. Because whereas same-sex has struck me, that's a very reasonable thought. People should not be forced, you know, to just have a child just to watch it die. Down syndrome, while I don't in any way minimize the right, the tremendous strain on the family, you know, it's not special that should ever happen to us. But as the questioner here asks, right, most of us are probably aware that there are any number of families who raise, right, who raise Down syndrome children successfully, right, and it's a source of great joy in their lives. And furthermore, there has been a number of claims that Down syndrome is possibly at least seriously mitigatable by early, right, by early heavy intervention therapy. And I simply, you know, and while I was willing to take the risk of allowing a same-sex abortion, knowing that there are probably some Rishonim who would think of it as at least manslaughter and possibly murder, right, that was, you know, I weighing the factors, I could at least be willing to send somebody to somebody who would postulate that it was permitted. But if the person, right, if I would have to say that, by the way, if you asked the same person the question about Down syndrome, it would also be okay, that just really got to me. Right? And to this day, I'm not sure what I would do anymore if I were confronted with this question, because I can't see following a position that would fairly blithely, I mean, not blithely, it's unfair, but from a halakhic perspective, right, really without too much agmat nefesh, permit the aborting of Down syndrome's children. Right? So when one decides new cases, one has to be aware of the consequences. And, therefore, if one is to rule that stem cell research is not problematic because embryos within 40 days are considered mere water and have no halakhic moral status, well, then one has a very hard time opposing the morning after pill. And I have a very hard time having any moral difficulty with abortion on demand during the first 40 days. But certainly, there's no reason one should have a higher standard for abortion on demand than one has for permitting, I guess whatever the standards are for Hadar Levatela, right, for seminal, right for non-procreational seminal emission, right. That's pretty much the criteria one would have to use, and it might not even be as high, because that might be a prohibition on the act, where this is on the object. Right, it's not entirely clear, although many Achronim struggle to try and find a prohibition for women to destroy sperm as well as for men to emit it needlessly, but it's not entirely clear they succeed. Certainly not entirely clear that such a prohibition applies to Gentiles, even if we think that all abortion for Gentiles is murder. Right? It's not at all clear that we think that that's true of destroying semen. And therefore, it seems to me that one has to be very cautious about the grounds on which one permits stem cell research, if one permits it, on the grounds that halakha gives no moral status to embryos less than 40 days, then you really have no basis for seriously objecting to elective abortion within 40 days. And there, I guess, that when, you know, so if you feel that way, great. If you feel, as I do, that whatever the halakhic status is, and being fully aware that this really age held, like the Ramban, that abortion is only drabanan, still living in a country which has between 1.5 and 3 million abortions a year over the past 2 decades, is really a frightening thing morally. And so I have to say that ground as such, to me, is a very scary ground for permitting it. We'll have to figure out, right, whether there's a way of modifying it, whether alternative grounds, but I find it a very scary way of doing it, because it seems to me that even if the result is right, the logic goes too far. Right, to really say, right, you know, in a case of severe need, I might be willing to rely on that position. But to say it's straight, right, but unless you can establish that this is severe need, it scares me a great deal. Okay, that is, right, that's issue number one.
Okay, so, a second ground, I should say, is to claim that an embryo created by an IVF. Okay,
now most stem cell research takes place on embryos that are created via in vitro fertilization, which means that the embryo has never been implanted in a human womb. Right, the alternative argument one can make is that even if one believes that abortion of a normal embryo within 40 days is a very serious halakhic violation, this simply doesn't apply to an embryo which has not been implanted in the womb, because an embryo which has not been implanted in the womb has no moral status. Now that has much, right, that gets rid of the implication I had before. The problem is, this seems like a very difficult position for me to take to anyone who has read Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Right, because if one has read Brave New World, so then one knows that one can conceive of a society in which all human beings are created without the interference of the human womb. Now, we don't need to go as far as Huxley. All we need to know is that it's not unlikely, right, in the next century, that we will develop the scientific capacity, to develop a full human being from embryos outside the womb. And grant, right, that we'll be able to recreate the chemical environment of the human host. And are we then going to say that a person born from in vitro fertilization has no legal moral status? Right, that's the consequence of that position. Right, there's no difference between that I can tell so far, between a 3-day-old embryo and a 50-year-old man. Right, if they were never implanted in the human womb. At the very least, there's no difference between a 3-day-old embryo and an 8.5 month, 8.5 month, something, right? Oops. Okay. Sorry. I wish I knew how to turn the ring around. Anyone knows how to play it? Okay, right. So, again, now it might be that somebody will be able eventually to develop a halakhic model which says that what causes a fetus to develop moral status is either implantation in the womb or the development of major organs. But one has to acknowledge that there is no precedent for any such position halakha. We would be making that up. I think it's a reasonable position, but since there's no precedent dealing with the issue of fetuses outside the womb, right, then nobody can say, oh, here's evidence, but I'm not aware. Maybe there's an address somewhere, about a sperm falling on an egg somewhere, and a child being born that way. I don't know. But I'm not aware of it. I haven't seen it cited in the literature. Absent that, it's not an unreasonable position. But I would want to be sure that somebody with authority was taking that before we moved on.
Okay. That's, right, so if one takes those two rationales, again, I think that the second rationale is reasonable but needs to be qualified. The first rationale is halakhically grounded but has consequences that I personally find scary. So the other approach is, to, right, is as opposed to saying that the, yes, right, Senator? Right? So one could come up with a more qualified approach, right, which I was going to get to at the end, which is the claim that it's not that a fetus outside the embryo has no status, it's that a fetus outside the embryo is considered already in the process of dying. And therefore, you're not actively destroying it because it already has no potential for life. Not that it's not, right, it has moral status, but it's already killed. Right? It's the equivalent of a trefa or a ghostase. I think that approach I would be more willing to entertain, realizing that, on the other hand, then you'll have to revisit halakha as the science changes in that regard. Right. So that would apply non-viable fetuses outside the womb? So at this point, you won't get past that point. You're going to claim anything which has independent viability, and in the womb is considered to have independent viability, even though it's inside the womb. And I understand the argument. That's just the feel issue. It seems to me, is it non-viable? You have to do something to save it, right? But it is viable, right? It can live, it can reproduce, you just have to put it somewhere. So I'd have to see exactly how one parses that argument. Offhand, it doesn't solve the problem that I'm raising for me, but I can see how somebody else would think differently. Okay. We will, right, we'll talk at the end when we get to the practical cases right now I'm talking about an abstraction. In reality, stem cell research takes place in a particular context, right? People use particular types of embryos, and those, right, most of which are likely to be destroyed anyway, and that may change the moral equation as well. You just have to be very careful how you write the legislation, if you do that. Right now we're talking about halakha. How halakha relates to the specific legislation on PAP is the second stage question. Yes, yeah. Okay, very good. Right, I was going to point out that, right, there are many, right, that the text calls something Mayadama here, and there are other contradictory texts. You can solve them by claiming all the other texts are post 40 days, or you can point out that the issue all these texts have in common, right, is that they refer to the halakhic consequences of the pregnancy and not the status of the, right, of the embryo itself. As against that, using the term maya ba'alma seems to be a description of the, right, of the fetus as opposed to of the pregnancy. But on a conceptual level, all three cases have an axis. Yeah, I agree entirely. Again, that's why I'm not so comfortable with saying that blithely.
Well, that's why I'm not comfortable. I'm fertilizing the
sperm. Okay, I think it's the simple reading of the text, but I also have the conceptual consequence is significant, and the Talmud only uses that in one context. Absolutely. Okay. The second approach one can take is to say that we don't really need to in any way diminish the value of the embryo. We have an explicit Mishnah which says that one is allowed to commit abortion to save a life. In fact, right, very likely one is mandated to commit abortion to save a life. So if we view this, if we view the medical research, that will come out of stem cells as being life-saving, so why do we need this argument at all? Right, let's just say, yeah, it's a form of abortion, but it's a form of abortion that will save lives. Right, so that becomes a question of how one relates halakhically to the possible benefits of medical research. Now that issue of the life claims it stems from a particular Gemara on Yuma Daf Tegimel relating to the effectiveness of particular forms of amulets. I'm not 100% sure that actually is the best source. It seems to me that from a halakhic perspective, probably this discussion stems from the Tshuva of Nodiv Yehuda, which you find on source number 5, although I should say, nothing I cite is not cited by Rabbi Weiss. It's very hard to find anything he doesn't cite. And to me, the really quite shocking thing is there are topics on which people write articles in English, which he's already written articles on, and which they haven't read his. And it's really kind of embarrassing when you read articles, claiming to be halakhically comprehensive, but all they have to do is take out a copy of Contemporary Halakhic Problems, and they would see that they missed, 10 or 11 of the primary sources.
It just astonishes me that people can still and publish articles, right, without even taking out the book to look. Okay. Another thing that has asked the question about the permissibility, a particular case in which someone died of some kidney stone, apparently, and an operation was performed in the patient's lifetime, seeking to enable them to pass the stone. The operation failed. The doctors who failed in the operation would like now to conduct an autopsy so that they can next time perform the operation more effectively. Right, was asked about the permissibility of autopsies for the sake of medical research in this particular case. Okay, to which Nadavita gives the following response. He says, look, the issue seems to be whether you're allowed to engage in nivul hamet, which I'm marring seems to be the best term I can come up with to translate what one does to a cadaver, when one injures a cadaver. He asks, since that is prohibited, so we just made it prohibited, or we say that because other lives will be saved as a result of this surgery, this autopsy, so how could we not allow marring the dead, to keep someone alive? Of course we allow it. And the process, Nadi Behuda says, he says, I wrote out all the arguments that you had, those are all your arguments, which deal with the question of assuming this is Bikuach Nefesh, can I or can't I engage in this? But he says, I don't understand your arguments. If it's Bikuach Nefesh, who needs any of your fancy arguments about what the person there argues maybe it's not really more, it's not disrespect to the dead, because what greater respect is there for the dead than using the dead to save lives? Issues like that. He says, what does it matter? If it's life-saving, it's life-saving. It could be Shabbos, We allow Shabbos. We allow violating Shabbos, It's not murder. It's not adultery. It's not idolatry. What's the question? Therefore, he says, you yourself must understand that this is not really a case of life-saving. Because if it were, you wouldn't bother asking the question. Okay, but why isn't it life-saving? They're gaining medical knowledge which will help us save other patients. All this is when there is danger to life before us, lifanenu. As with a person who is currently ill, or if somebody is under a pile of rubble which has just collapsed. That's when you're allowed to violate Shabbat, When someone is already ill, or when somebody is already in physical danger. But in this case, it says there is no sick person who needs this. Rather, they seek to gain the skill, as perhaps the sick person will present who needs this. And certainly we do not push aside, because of this light concern, any biblical prohibition, or even rabbinic prohibition. Because if you were to call this a doubt concerning life, then forget allowing autopsies, for medical research. We should allow any type of medical practice at all, We should allow making medicines, grinding medicines on Shabbat, which is the explicit thing that Talmud prohibits. Grinding medicines on Shabbat. And it permits other things, because you might come to grind medicines on Shabbat. So you should always be allowed to grind medicines on Shabbat, because maybe somebody will come along to sick. And needs that. Or you should be able, to, in a place where bloodletting is a major tool, so you should be allowed to sharpen your scalpels. Because maybe a patient will need an operation. And in the end, there will be no restrictions whatsoever on medical practice, and he finds that inconceivable. Heaven forfend that we permit this. And he used rhetorically, even Gentile doctors don't experiment in the field of surgery on any cadaver other than those executed by the courts or those who agreed to such in their lifetime. If God forbid we'd be lenient in this matter, all the dead will be cut so as to learn the arrangement and nature of internal organs. We'll have anatomy labs, using cadavers by the dozens. And that, he thinks, is just morally intolerable. Therefore, he concludes that we do not even allow autopsies for the sake of medical research, even in a case in which you're dealing with a specific narrow field of medical knowledge, and it's not at all unlikely that somebody's going to present with kidney stone in the near future. We're not talking about a distant possibility. We're talking about a narrow possibility. Yes, you had a question.
So, it's just a problem. Hmm?
That's true. We'll get back to autopsies. But stem cell research, you can't say that about it because all the benefits are hypothetical. There is no current therapy.
How you define
all areas of research?
Most areas.
Interesting. I'm not sure. I'd have to find a study to figure out how you determine the percentage of investigative areas that lead to effective therapy.
I mean, think of a particular application of therapy.
But then all scientific research eventually has medical applications. Why specifically medical research? Right, all scientific research in some way, right?
I think astronomy may be a stretch.
No, but let's say, the internal combustion engine, right? Right, leads us to build faster automobiles that let us get sick people to hospital faster. Right, it has a tremendous effect on the mortality of heart attacks.
But you don't have to do that.
Okay, so you might argue we only do that on Shabbat. I think it probably wouldn't be so hard to find specific medical applications.
I'm making a great argument for medical.
Okay, well, that depends on how far you want to take it. If you had a question before.
No?
Yeah. Okay, so before we go on, let me finish this section, right, and I'll explain, right, because I don't want to have myself line up behind this, because I understand legitimately, right, and I put it in because you should know where it comes from. That doesn't mean that I don't think that your objections aren't perfectly well taken. Okay, second trip along the same lines, is the Sam Sofer, that's source number 6. And the Sam Sofer deals with a case in which somebody sought to sell his body for medical research. And he wanted to sell his cadaver for medical research. Was he permitted to sell his cadaver for medical research? So the Sam Sofer says, you know what? We could say simply that it's prohibited to derive benefits from a dead body, and so you can't even derive benefits from your own dead body. It's an interesting argument. But he says you're going to tell me, but I'm using my body to save lives, right? So I'm furthering medical education. How can that be forbidden? So he makes the same type of argument. He says, if you're going to say that, right, then all medical education should be permitted, should push aside Shabbat. Right? So it can't be. Right, it can't be. Right, it says that we can't allow an argument which considers all medical knowledge to be life-saving, because then all these prohibitions would just vanish. Right, basically, there should be no, doctors would live in a Shabbat-free zone. Right, there's a joke I love telling. Right, about three Hasidim arguing about which of their rebbeim is greater. The first one says, "My Rebbe is greater." How do you know? Well, once we were making our way through. And we were late for Shabbat, and we came to a river, and we had to get across it for Shabbat, and there was water to the right of us, and water to the left of us, and we walked straight through on dry land. The second one says, that's nothing. Once we had to get home for Shabbat, and there was a battle taking place in front of us, and there were bullets to the right of us, and bullets to the left of us, and we walked straight through, and nothing touched us. And the third one says, that's nothing. I remember once we were walking along on Shabbat, and all of a sudden we found $1,000 bill. And it was Shabbat to the right of us, and Shabbat to the left of us, and we walked straight through. So the doctors will be living in that kind of zone, right? The Shabbat to the right of them, Shabbat to the left of them, and you walk, right, and they walk straight through. Which we see to some degree now with beepers, right? It actually is a case, although Reb Leib actually thinks there is such a case. If you believe that Shabbat ending time is based on the sun going below the horizon where you are, so it turns out that if you're on a very high, narrow peak, right, so Shabbat, right, so when Shabbat will end before you much earlier than the people on your right and left, right, because the sun will go below your horizon before anybody else's, so in fact it will be Shabbat to the right and Shabbat to the left, and you can stay on your peak and walk straight through. So the Sam Sofer and the Rebbe Yehuda both take the position that we can't see, right, that we can't see medical research as such as life-saving, because if that were the case, they feel that the restrictions which they think are both socially necessary and inescapable from the Talmudic text on the practice of medicine and certainly medical education, right, become intolerable. Now, issues about medical education have broad there are other areas where history plays a role in that, particularly as anatomy became necessary for medical education. We have the problem of many generations of Kohanim who became doctors all of a sudden being told they can't go to medical school, right? Their children can't go to medical school because medical education changes, right? And that same issue comes up there. If all medical education is life-saving, right, so then how can we claim that Kohanim are not permitted to go to medical school if they're going to save lives? Right? And there are all sorts of halakhic discussions about that.
What I'm more interested in setting up as an opposition is Yitzhak Herzog, the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel, in his book, A Halachic Constitution for the State of Israel, says, you know what? In a modern state, we have to have a modern medical system. A modern medical system requires a public health system. A modern public health system requires autopsies. Right? Regular autopsies. That's how contemporary public health works. And therefore, he says, without any real hesitation, that if there were a halachic state, we would permit routine autopsies for the sake of medical knowledge. And so far as I know, the current Israeli government policy regarding autopsies in hospitals does not require extraordinary necessity. Right? Then you can help correct me if I'm wrong. I think that's the case, right? So we're going to move back to just the question of how one evaluates a halachic situation in the context of a changing reality, right? Which is really what the issue, is here, right? So I would suggest is that on the one hand, right, the grounds for permitting it are not as exuberantly clear, perhaps I think as certain statements made on the subject seem to show. On the other hand, the grounds, right, everyone agrees that if it's life-saving, it's permitted. You don't need any arguments. And the grounds for arguing this is not life-saving, I tend to agree with the consensus of the audience, that even though I think the argument that we distinguish that our medical research is more effective than the Noda Behuda thought, we believe our medical research to be more effective than the Noda Behuda thought his research was, I'm not sure. I don't know. You know, when we're talking there about a very specific learning curve, right? Surgery for a particular condition. I myself find I'm unconvinced that if the Noda Behuda were here, he would say, "Oh, of course, our research is much more likely to yield results than theirs." I'm not sure. I don't know what he thought of medical practice. If he was a cynic about doctors in general, that would explain a lot, right? And we know that as late as the 18th century, more people were killed by medicine than saved. Right, so it may be that that he simply believed that relying on doctors was not medically useful in any way. But if he didn't, you're dealing with a cadaver that was killed by the doctor, right? Or at least the doctor failed to save, and for all we know, the patient died of complications of the surgery and would have passed the stone if they hadn't operated. So on the one hand, it seems to me that the grounds for permitting it without dealing with life-saving as an issue are far less clear than sometimes argued. On the other hand, the ground for arguing this can't be permitted because of life-saving, while that is very well grounded in the halachic literature, right? I think it is clearly the implication of the Noda Behuda and the Sam Sofer. I think that contemporary halacha, starting with the Herzog, but moving on, I think to basically almost all poskim that work with contemporary medicine, has a much more positive vision of medical research, and tends to take the routinization of practices that the Noda Behuda forbade as something that we can live with perfectly well. Right, so the question, right? So I think that both sides of the precedent, right, don't work particularly well. So the question then is, how do we deal, right, with what I think is really a new situation? There's a number of ways in which one can approach it. I gave you source number 7, which you can just look at later, where just give you an illustration, which the Chabad Yair talks about. He's dealing with the question of aborting a mamzer, the child of an adulterous union. And he says, look, we can distinguish between 40 days and quickening, right, the first trimester, and all sorts of things like that. He says, and all these distinctions have some basis. We don't make halachic decisions because we just have a gut feeling. They call Zoras Akeras, right, the rationale of the gut. Right, and that I think is a good caution against making facile analogies, which I think is what is among the things that he's critiquing. But on the other hand, this is something that will lead very much into what we'll do Sunday night. There's a Ramban, a famous Ramban, which I'm citing only a small part of, who says that when we say that the Torah gives permission to doctors to heal, that means that doctors heal even though they know full well that sometimes they'll kill the patients. Right? That's a striking statement, because under ordinary circumstances, we would say that if there's a chance of killing somebody, so shave al tans yadif, right? If there's a chance of saving somebody or a chance of killing somebody, so be passive. Right? So Rabban says that the practice of medicine is different. And the practice of medicine permits and perhaps even requires taking risks. Right? And that may mean that that gives us an approach. Right? It tells us that we have the right to be somewhat aggressive in the pursuit of major life-saving therapies. Right? Because there's an explicit mandate in the Torah for taking more chances with murder in the practice of medicine than we would in other areas, than we would in other areas of life. So it seems to me, right, that really, if I were to come up with a sense, I would say that there should be a good deal of caution in regard to, right, in regard to simply saying that there is no reason to object, and that it might be that we still come to a positive conclusion on the grounds that we have a much more positive evaluation of medical research, right, and we give it more force in halakhic literature than is granted in precedent. But there are qualifications in that as well, because of the reality we live in. One reality is that right now, the only way to get effective stem cells for research is by aborting embryos. But there are at least claims, certainly in fundamentalist Christian scientific circles, right, that it will be fairly rapidly possible to develop, equivalent materials based on stem cells extracted from living people, right? Which never have to be, right? Which never have to be embryos. In principle, there's no reason that the technique of cloning should apply specifically to gametes, right? So it may be that, right, that we'll end up having permitted it, looking back 2 years later and saying, what have we done? And it was all unnecessary, right? Secondly, right, although when we read legislation, it's very important to try and see if legislation really distinguishes between reproductive cloning, right, and research cloning in a very clear way. And thirdly, I think, right, that much of the practical moral debate, right, I think legitimately comes down to the following issue. The design, right, as of now, there are more than enough embryos sitting in freezers, right, or produced simply to be thrown out in the process of in vitro fertilization, right, right, which nobody really feels that you're causing fewer embryos to develop than would otherwise. You're doing stem cell research on fetuses that would otherwise be disposed of. When IVF started, there was a whole halakhic debate about whether, in fact, it was permissible to produce embryos that would not be implanted, and then once they were implanted, whether you were obligated to pay for permanent frozen storage. In practice, for better or for worse, halakha has not developed that way, and most from Jews who use IVF do it in the standard way, which is to say that many eggs are fertilized, and some are implanted, and the others are disposed of, or allowed, not disposed of, actively allowed to deteriorate. We don't require you to continue paying the storage fee past the year or whatever it may be. So in practice, right, there's an argument which says that, well, we might feel very cautious about actively aborting. On the other hand, we do feel strongly about medical research. These fetuses aren't really going to develop anyway. Right? So on a moral level, it's not really so problematic to us. And then we can figure out what the specific halakhic justification for that may be. Maybe Rabbi Schermbuch's approach, right, has the consequences that we need to generate the argument. But it's very important, right? But I think most people, even though, again, halakhically there's no difference, and formally, most people have an intuitive feel that allowing embryos to be produced solely to be destroyed for research, right, somehow rubs against the moral bone. Right? Even though the halakhic arguments don't really distinguish. Right? Right, maybe, right, for Jews it would argue that there's a problem of producing sperm, right, to fertilize an egg which won't then be implanted would be problematic. But for non-Jews, not, right, it's not at all clear there should be an issue at all. Yet I think most Jews and others correctly feel that there's clearly something awry in creation when you produce a potential human life solely to destroy it for the sake of research. And so one has to be careful both that the legislation is written to prevent that, I would think, and secondly, that the halakhic rationale is formulated so as not to permit that. It seems to me that there is very much room in halakhic literature for under particular circumstances, to permit stem cell research, but I would say cautiously. Now, there's one other factor that needs to be thrown in here, which is why I quoted the Sam Sofer. which is the question, right, the Chasam points out that there's a second prohibition, aside from abortion, which is getting benefit from the dead. And what that would, the consequence here would be, what is the motive for the stem cell research? Right, so first, one issue which is addressed in the Massachusetts legislation is whether donors can be compensated. Now, I myself am not so comfortable with the language, but you know, the language is, you know, except for what may be determined to be reasonable expenses. That's got a lot of wiggle room in it. Right, because right, if reasonable expenses include shkar batala, in halachic terms, right, we pay you for your time. So for unemployed women, that ends up being quite a bit of money. Furthermore, right, most of the guidelines say things like, and we'll appoint an ethical committee to oversee the legitimate research to make sure that the research, for example, is being done only on life-saving issues and not on cosmetics. What that is doing is passing the ethical buck, in my opinion. Right, you're saying, we're not going to make up the rules. We're going to hand it to somebody else whom you don't know, and they're going to make up the rules. And all you're doing is voting to authorize people who may, in fact, believe that there are no rules. Right? So I'm not comfortable, right? At least I think one should acknowledge that when one says something like that, that we're going to appoint a committee to determine the ethics, what you're doing is abdicating as opposed to, right, as opposed to making a decision. In the Massachusetts context, right, it struck me that there was a challenge between the one form of rhetoric was we need to save lives, but the pragmatic argument was we need to keep the pharmaceutical industry in Massachusetts. And that was, you know, on the whole, right, and the argument was even if you have hesitations about it, but some other state will do it, California's already pouring hundreds of millions of dollars in. And so if we don't pour hundreds of million dollars into it, we're going to lose the best and the brightest. That there it strikes me that the argument about Hana, right, Hana and I'm uncomfortable with the rhetoric. It may not change anything in practice. Right? It may be right, but I'm uncomfortable with the rhetoric saying that we make a decision of such ethical significance on the grounds of economic advantage. And I think that has to be addressed. One other point that has to be made, I think, and this is a point Rabbi Leif makes, and I think with Tovasta, Rabbi Leif is the only post-Sikh in America who would make this argument. He says that there are two different issues. One is, should we allow stem cell research? The second is, should we fund it? Should we fund it from the state? Right? Should the state fund it? And there you have a fair question as to whether the state should fund something which is in deep violation of the consciences of a significant percentage of the population. Right, because there's no denying that it is in violation of the conscience from Catholics. So the question of whether one should do that, I think Rabbi Leif is the only one who makes this argument, that even if we ourselves don't have a problem with it, right, but we should be cautious about mandating spending other people's money for things that they find in deep violation of consequence. With all that, I think that if one comes to the scientific determination that stem cell research is something so promising that one is willing to regard it as immediate life-saving, or alternatively, right, if one finds the arguments about the permissibility of early-term abortion to be so powerful that one thinks one can use a much lower standard of immediacy, of medical immediacy, for that kind of abortion than one can use for other types of issues, right? It seems to me that there's plenty of room in halacha to permit. I think that certainly, right, you know, if it turned out, say in 10 years, that you know we solved Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, right, and MS, and and lots of other diseases on the basis of stem cell research, I was still really stupid. If it turned out 10 years ago I banned this research on the grounds, right, on the ground that it doesn't have any it doesn't have any immediate medical benefit, prove it to me first. But of course, you can't prove it to me without doing the research. Right, and so the only way to demonstrate its effectiveness is to engage in it or not. So my own sense would be that a very cautious permission with parallel research for parallel research on non-destructive modes of engaging in the same research would be the halakhically ideal solution. But halakha and politics don't mix particularly well. So I understand that when one is voting, that's not the choice you get. Right, the choice you get is whether to vote for stem cell research full speed ahead, right, or whether to stop it entirely. right? Which it seems to me is the kind of question that perhaps is best solved in a halakhic context, but not by a tzak. Right, although that in itself is a complicated question. All right, that's the end of right, of my presentation. Now you can all jump down my throat. Go ahead, Bender. I always look forward to it when you do. I would say, in the Rambam, unquestionably you're right, that this case wouldn't work according to the Rambam because he needs Rodit, and very likely the others are, you're right. That's too facile a comment that should be qualified. I think that's absolutely true. The only comment I have on the first one is, and this is my own experience, you know, I spoke for Hadassah as an emergency substitute for Rabbi Samuels on this topic, and I gave, a more positive view than I did tonight. But, you know, still it qualified you as the Gil Sigal, the ethicist sat next to me, but that was irrelevant, right? Because the only issue there was voting yes on the bill in front of the Senate or no. Right? And when the newspaper reports came in, it was just so-and-so spoke in favor. So I'm nervous, you know, I'm nervous about saying the halakha permits X, when really, right, the question facing people is not whether to implement the halakhic regime, right? It's, you know, like the question of whether halakha permits, you know, political activism on the ground that it will lead to a halakhic state. Right? So that doesn't address the question of whether one should be religiously Zionist or not. Right? Because that's not, right? Because the question is not the permissibility of a Jewish halakhic state. The question is what one does with a Jewish non-halakhic state. So, that might be helpful if a particular scientist comes and asks you the question about what kind of research he can engage in, but it doesn't really solve the question of the public policy position of the Jewish community. Unless we have a lot more power than I'm aware of. Yes, you had a question a long time ago, Mark. Yeah,
it actually comes with my experience. The subject is a very particular book of modality. That seems to be
That's a terrific question. And you're right, that should take a separate lecture. I'll try and answer it really briefly. That's a terrific question, and we should try and find a way to have the full discussion in some context. I don't think that that we should vote for the mandating of Shmirat Shabbat. Right? I don't think so. But I think that questions like, I think that, for example, if one really believes that abortion is murder, right? So it strikes me that one is mandated to vote for self-interest, right, over the prevention of murder, right, is immoral. If one really believes that abortion is murder, right, I think you, right, and that you're voting a particular way will prevent it, right, and so I'm qualifying that because you might think abortion is murder and still vote for liberal abortion laws on the grounds that all voting against it does is drive it underground and kill women. I'm perfectly okay with that morally, right? But I think that on issues of Be'alim L'Chavero, basically, right, so one has an obligation to try and construct a society that lives up to your values. Right, you don't have any values, right? If you're, you know, a really deeply religious person, you don't have any secular values. So to claim that you should be an amoral being when you vote, right, I don't accept that. Now there are counter values, right? There's a value of autonomy, right? It doesn't mean that you vote to coerce other people, right, to engage, right, to follow your morality, right? And how one balances, right, coercion versus endorsement, right? That's a complicated question. But I don't accept the position that because I arrive at my definition of personhood religiously, right, therefore I'm not allowed to have a voice on issues like that. I do think that it's wise to use universal ethical rhetoric, right, as opposed to private halakhic rhetoric in discussions. I don't see how else, right, to claim that I should be morality and my morality is religious should be irrelevant to the way in which I carry out my duties as an American citizen. That doesn't make sense to me. Right?
Yeah.
But we could debate technically, right, whether we're required to impose mitzvot be'noach or not. Michael Broyd has an interesting article on that. My students know I have a very, very strong position on that, which I think the best simple formulation of it is Rabbi Lam, so halakha is minimal Judaism. Yeah. Okay. That's a. I'll just say it very simply. No, I don't think that. Yes. They don't result. No, embryos don't result from somatic nuclear transfer. That's not what we're talking about. Somatic nuclear transfer is. Yeah, but that's, but the embryo already exists. The reproduction takes place through. Sorry, no, you're right. No, you're right. You're right, Michael. Right, you're right. You start. You put the nucleus into right into the egg. Yes. Yeah, I'm assuming that embryos produced by non-sexual means are the equivalent of embryos produced by sexual means. Well, again, so you have two possibilities. You can either distinguish between embryos produced by physical sex between human beings and other embryos, in which case IVF embryos don't have a Lachic status either. Right? Even regular IVF status. You can distinguish between embryos produced by fertilization and embryos produced by somatic nuclear transfer, but where in Halakha do you get that distinction? I could make it up, right? Where do you get that? Halakha doesn't, you know, not clear that Halakha has a concept of fertilization in that way. If it does, you know, it uses the agricultural metaphor in at least one place, right, that the seed is planted in the egg, right? It certainly doesn't, right, the rabbis were not aware of, right, of meiosis and mitosis, right? So I think it's mitzvara, it's a reasonably strong distinction, but for me to claim that's what Halakha is grounded on, now that's an interesting argument. You know, although again, the challenge is if we ever do succeed in cloning full human beings, right, then we'll have to claim they're not really human beings. Hard for you to imagine that we can produce a sheep and we can't produce a human being, even if it's not a very good sheep. I thought so. And, you know, it's hard for me to imagine that we can produce a sheep and not a human being. It's not that much more complicated. Maybe. The problem is that this is one of the many areas where people's science is produced to meet their political agenda, rather than the other way around, and you really just can't rely on almost all. I mean, I know, you know, I spoke with a major Harvard practitioner on this, and, you know, people produce the science to support their, right, to support their goals, and it's very hard to trust the science produced by advocates, and since very few people are neutral, it's very hard to find science that isn't produced by advocates. So I really don't know what to say. Okay, I'm more cynical. Yeah, I'm more cynical about that, particularly in cutting edge areas where there's major funding at stake. But that's the other thing. I'm not the scientific world. Okay. All right, last question, I think.
So, just want to ask
how religious Christians or post-Semitic religious people are really part of that. I think it's the other side, right? Now I'm looking now. Apparently, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a reference in one of his truvos to a, right, to a drasha he wrote about why we should be so appreciative of American religious pluralism. Right. So, which is not something I would have thought of Rav Moshe's writing. I don't have access to the book, and I'm really, you know, looking forward to finding it. I think that's a challenge in general of living in a liberal democracy, right? How one chooses between, you know, being entirely amoral. And at the same time, one has to prevent murder, right? And the fact that, right, most of us acknowledge that the fact that some people think African Americans aren't human doesn't constrain us from passing laws against lynching, right? 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 Even if it might be that their logic is based on their interpretation of Evad Avadim, and they even have an Idrash, right? At one point, right, which seems to support that, right? So how you balance slavery, right? Right. There are, you can find a midrash that supports slavery. Slavery particularly of blacks. Right? I reject that, right? I don't think that I feel constrained against imposing that on people. But I don't feel I should be constrained against imposing restrictions against murder as well. I think that, you know, to some degree I have a right to impose a socially just system which mandates the minimal support for the poor. Right. I think that in labor areas, you know, I want to advocate for employee autonomy, dignity, and job portability, right, which I see as halachic values. Right. You know, but how one balances that with the fact that there are other people who, based on their own religious decisions, have other things, right, have different arguments, and we don't think either morally that we should impose it on us or practically. And this, I recall, Rabbi Samuels made this argument very well in the debate over the gay marriage amendment. I said, let's suppose that we, right, that we really believe that that gay marriage is really, really wrong. But the fact is that this amendment was passed in Massachusetts because of a particular religious perspective. We may not want to get into the habit of having Christian religious sentiments legislated constitutionally mandated. And that may just be bad for the Jews. Right? And therefore, you know, he was one of the three of us, you know, there was Dr. Roberts in the Boston area who thought that if we were to publish a statement on gay marriage, right, we should not necessarily, even as we opposed it, did not necessarily mean that we sought the appropriate remedy for the constitutional amendment. And I think that we're not often sufficiently sensitive to the need to pay attention. It's ironic that those of us who are with halachic lifestyles who are so subject to process, right, are not always sufficiently appreciative of the necessity of taking account of political process as well as results. But I think that's something we could definitely gain. But, you know, so I'm glad my Rebbe is the one who has the way to do that. All right. Thank you very, very much. And I hope we'll see you all at Future Next. Thank you very much.